Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, July 29th, 2021. President Joe Biden requiring all civilian federal employees and contractors be vaccinated against COVID-19 or abide by conditions, including regular testing, mask wearing, and social distancing. Coming up, we'll hear from the president and talk with a reporter with Federal News Network about how this might play out. Commerce Department says the U.S. economy grew by 6.5% in the second quarter. Solid growth, but not as strong as analysts had predicted. U.S. Senate and House passing a $2.1 billion emergency spending bill to increase U.S. capital security and also help Afghan interpreters who worked with U.S. troops get out of that country. Bill now heads to President Biden for his expected signature into law. And the Senate starts on amendments to the $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure spending bill after Wednesday night's vote to move forward. Before we get to COVID-19 and the president's announcement, First Lady Jill Biden's spokesman, Michael LaRosa, issuing a statement that reads, "Last weekend, prior to her two official events in Hawaii, the First Lady stepped on an object on the beach, which became lodged in her left foot. She will undergo a procedure today at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center to remove the object. The president will join her." Now to President Biden's announcement that all civilian federal employees and contractors numbering in several millions must get a COVID-19 vaccine or be regularly tested for the virus and follow precautions like mask wearing. This as daily COVID-19 cases in the U.S. are higher than 1 year ago and less than half the country is fully vaccinated. Here's the president.
Every federal government employee will be asked to attest to their vaccination status. Anyone who does not attest or is not vaccinated will be required to mask no matter where they work, test one or two times a week to see if they've acquired COVID, socially distance, and generally will not be allowed to travel for work. Likewise, today, I'm directing my administration to take steps to apply similar standards to all federal contractors. If you want to do business with the federal government, get your workers vaccinated. Look at the Chamber of Commerce, representing tens of thousands of American businesses, the National Association of Manufacturers, the Business Roundtable, which comprises of the largest and biggest corporations in America. They're all applauding the actions the federal government is taking and urge them to follow suit. I also commend the National Football League, that has announced that if there are outbreaks among unvaccinated players and personnel, then the team risks forfeiting games. I urge other sport leagues at every level to take every step they can. Every day, more businesses are implementing their own vaccine mandates. And the Justice Department has made it clear that it is legal to require COVID-19 vaccines. We all want our lives to get back to normal. And fully vaccinated workplaces will make that happen more quickly and more successfully. We all know that in our gut. With incentives and mandates, we can make a huge difference and save a lot of lives.
President Biden at the White House, some of those incentives that he announced today, federal government will reimburse companies for giving paid time off for employees and the employees' families to get vaccinated. And he's calling on state and local governments to use funds from the COVID relief bill, the nearly $2 trillion bill from earlier this year, to offer people $100 to get a vaccine. But on that federal employee requirement, an article at federalnewsnetwork.com includes this line: "The legality of vaccine mandates is clear, federal employment attorneys said, but implementing them unleashes a whole host of potentially thorny questions for both employees and their agencies." We spoke with the reporter on that story, Nicole Ogrisco, and asked her about those thorny questions.
So the first thorny question is exactly how it's going to be implemented. And at this point, we're not entirely sure who specifically a vaccine requirement might apply to. But for right now, we know that there are still federal employees teleworking, working from home. And so The question would be whether a vaccine policy might apply to them or only frontline workers. Of course, agencies are trying to bring more employees back at this point. So that's one question. The other is, of course, how they might collect vaccination status information from employees. So far, agencies have said different things about that. In the past, you know, some agencies have said you can't even ask employees about it. Others have said you can ask, but you can't, you know, force an answer out of them. And so there are questions about how they'll ask employees, how they'll collect vaccination information, how they'll store it and secure it. And then, of course, if there are testing requirements, how the testing itself will work, how that information will be collected and stored, and who has access to it.
When it comes to saying that the mandate is clear, what is the legal history of these types of mandates?
So the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission in May issued some guidance on this and essentially said that federal equal employment opportunity laws don't prohibit an employer from requiring that their employees who might physically enter a workplace can be vaccinated against COVID-19. And then just recently, the Justice Department posted a legal opinion essentially looking at whether or not the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act prohibits public or private sector employers from imposing a vaccine mandate on their employees, even if the vaccine is only under emergency use authorization, as these COVID-19 vaccines currently are. And the Justice Department said that there isn't anything that would prohibit that as well. And then one other thing I would mention is, you know, there's a 2002 case where the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit upheld the Navy's decision to fire two civilian employees who refused the anthrax vaccine before deploying on a naval ship to Korea. And the court agreed with the Navy and said that, you know, their firings were not excessive and that, you know, the employees essentially disobeyed a direct order.
Does it make a difference that the president offered an alternative to a vaccine mandate, testing, masking, social distancing, when it comes to the legality of these type of policies?
I'm not sure that it matters in a legal sense, but it might assuage some who are concerned about having to face a cut and dry mandate. So job or vaccine, working for the government or not, essentially. And so maybe perhaps giving employees choices about how they might approach this question might alleviate some of those concerns from employees and also their unions who, you know, have been working with the Biden administration pretty closely on other issues. The administration's actively trying to restore labor relations with federal employee unions. And I think this falls within a sticky territory potentially for them. And so maybe giving employees choices helps address some of those concerns. But I'm not necessarily sure it's explicitly covering up any kind of legal questions there. I think, you know, the attorneys that we've talked to say that there isn't really much of a constitutional argument when it comes to a vaccine mandate.
We're talking with Nicola Grisco from Federal News Network. Finally, you referenced that if a federal employee under this mandate simply says, no, I will not be vaccinated and I'm not going to abide by those stringent requirements, that it's not an automatic disciplinary case, that in fact, there's going to be procedures. Explain what that means.
So federal employees have due process rights if they face some sort of disciplinary action. And the employment attorneys we've spoken to say, you know, that'll apply here as well. And of course, it all depends on what the policy is. If it really is a strict vaccine mandate, then of course, you know, firing, removal, other kind of disciplinary action might come into play more quickly. But if there are alternatives and an employee refuses to comply with any of the alternatives, you know, the assumption is that the employees would have to go through a disciplinary process. You know, they have to receive advance notice of a disciplinary action. Often they have, depending on the employee, a chance to appeal. So there's, you know, a process that employees are used to at this point. And so the thinking is that that same process would apply even though these questions about vaccines and the COVID-19 pandemic are pretty novel ones for the government at this point.
Nicole Ogrisco, reporter with Federal News Network. Find her stories at federalnewsnetwork.com. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And President Biden saying when it comes to members of the armed forces, there will not be a mandate for vaccinations at this point. He said, since many vaccinations are required for active duty military today, I'm asking the Defense Department to look into how and when they will add COVID-19 to the list of vaccinations that our armed forces must get. President speaking in the White House East Room, he also took a couple of questions. And as he was leaving, there was a question that was asked of him about the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reversal on mask guidance, saying that with the rise in COVID cases, people should now be wearing masks indoors in places with a high prevalence. It's a little difficult to hear the president as he was walking away from the microphone, but here's the question and answer.
President, you said if you are fully vaccinated, you no longer need to wear a mask. And it seems...
No, I didn't say. I have said if you're fully vaccinated in an area where we do not have... Let me clarify.
In May, you made it sound like a vaccine was the ticket to losing the mask forever. And
that is true at the time, because I thought there were people who were going to understand that getting vaccinated made a gigantic difference. And what happened was, the new variant came along, they didn't get vaccinated, it was spread more rapidly, and more people were getting sick. That's the
difference.
Questions to President Biden at the White House. Up on Capitol Hill, House Republicans who are members of the Freedom Caucus held a news conference during which President Biden's announcement on the federal employee vaccination requirement came up, as well as masks. This week's announcement by Speaker Nancy Pelosi that masks will again be required by all in the U.S. House chamber, regardless of vaccination status. Congressman Andy Biggs chairs the Freedom Caucus.
A document came out this morning. And in that document, it said that staff members and guests on this in this Capitol complex, as our Democrat friends always say, the people's house, if they don't comply to a mask request or mandate, they can be arrested. I want you to think about that. That is more indication of the authoritarian turn of Nancy Pelosi. Her tyranny, quite frankly, knows no bounds. And why would that be important to us as members of Congress? It affects us for sure. And we think it is irresponsible and certainly tyrannical. Yes. But I will tell you something about this. What happens here will be reflected throughout the entire population of the United States of America. Already, Joe Biden, President Biden, is talking about making mandates on federal employees and people who have contracts with the federal government. This will filter out, and that will basically obfuscate and abrogate our rights as Americans. We're going to fight this. We'll fight it as the Freedom Caucus, and we will fight this as Americans.
Congressman Andy Biggs, Republican, is chair of that caucus, part of a news conference outside the U.S. Capitol building today. Politico has an article that reads Congressman Chip Roy confronted House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy on Thursday about a new Capitol Police bulletin that suggests congressional staffers and visitors could be arrested if they fail to heed the chamber's new mask mandate. This is BS. We need to lead, Roy, a member of the Conservative Freedom Caucus, told McCarthy during a brief meeting of GOP lawmakers in a Capitol reception room, according to two sources familiar with the exchange. McCarthy replied to a frustrated Roy that his plan is to win back the majority in 2022 and become speaker, the sources said. Read more at Politico.com. Pfizer released data on Wednesday showing that a third dose of the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine can strongly boost protection against the Delta variant beyond the protection of the standard two doses. The CEO of AstraZeneca, Pascal Soriot, asked today on CNBC if a booster shot of his vaccine would be needed.
At the moment, there's a lot of conversation around how quickly antibody levels decline after both shots and whether it's necessary for us to start administering booster shots. Can I get your view on that? Do you think it will be necessary to start doing that soon in developed markets where two shots have already been delivered. And can I ask you where AstraZeneca sits on the provision of those boosters?
Yeah, it's a great question. And in fact, I don't think we have the precise answer yet, because there are two dimensions to this immunity. One is the antibodies, and you're right to say that antibody levels decline over time. But the second very important dimension of immunization is the so-called T cells, memory cells that protect people. They tend to protect people against severe disease, but they also provide durability. With the technology we use, the so-called adenoviral vector, we have very high production of T cells. So we are hoping that we can have a durable vaccine that protects for a long period of time. So whether we will need a third booster or not is not clear yet. Only time will tell. The only way to know is really to watch whether efficacy declines over time. We know that Pfizer has announced that they can see a decline of antibodies and efficacy. We also know we do have a decline of antibody. We haven't seen yet a decline of efficacy, but it's a little bit early to judge. Only time will tell. And I hope the T cells will provide this durable long-term protection.
Pascal Soriot, CEO of AstraZeneca, the British-Swedish drug maker planning to seek full approval by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration for its COVID-19 vaccine the second half of 2021, the company announcing in a report on its second quarter results today. Emergent BioSolutions says the FDA will allow it to resume the manufacturing of the drug substance that goes into Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccine. CNN reporting, according to an administration official, the Baltimore plant has not been fully authorized yet, and while production can resume, the FDA will still need to inspect the individual lots of vaccine before they go out for shipment and can be administered. The plant was shut down after 15 million doses of the vaccine were contaminated. On Wall Street, the Dow up 153, NASDAQ up 15, S&P up 18. White House calling on Congress to pass an emergency extension of an eviction ban with 3 days until it expires. White House saying the president would like to extend the moratorium on his own, but does not have the legal power to do so after a recent Supreme Court ruling. Moratorium was put in place last September by the CDC to protect people who were having trouble paying the rent with the shutdown of the economy during the height of the pandemic. This from Associated Press, fueled by vaccinations and government aid, the U.S. economy grew at a solid 6.5% annual rate last quarter, in another sign that the nation has achieved a sustained recovery from the pandemic recession. Total size of the economy has now surpassed its pre-pandemic levels. The quarterly figure was less than analysts had expected, but that was mainly because supply chain bottlenecks exerted a stronger than predicted drag on companies' efforts to restock their shelves. That was all from AP. At the White House, Deputy Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
Today's GDP numbers are further proof of the progress we've had jump-starting our economy. With today's data, the U.S. economy has now made up the losses of the last 18 months and surpassed the pre-pandemic GDP peak. In fact, in the first year of the first half of this year, the economy grew at the latest rate in nearly 40 years. It took 2 years after the last recession to return to the previous level. Today, it took half as long. You can see how far we've come just by looking at where we were this time last year. In the second quarter of 2020, we saw the largest decline in GDP on record, a decline of more than 31%. That's the story of the president's economic plan, taking us from the worst time of our economy in history to one of the best. The reversal is no accident. It's the result of President Biden's plan to curb COVID and deliver economic relief to families, small businesses, and communities throughout the country. At that strength isn't just being reflected in today's GDP's number, it's being seen across the economy. Earlier this month, we learned that the economy created 850,000 jobs in June, as you all know, with a range of 600,000 jobs created each month since the president took office. That's a total of over 3 million jobs created under President Biden. More jobs than any other president's first 4 months in history, and importantly, We're seeing better jobs with higher wages across the country. Recent independent forecasts from the Congressional Budget Office and the International Monetary Fund both doubled their projections for America's economic growth this year to the fastest pace in almost 40 years. The last time the economy was growing this fast, Ronald Reagan was telling us it was morning in America. And I think I was about 5 years old. So there's that. And this boom is backed by other signs across the economy. Consumer confidence is up, jobs are up, personal income is up, and unemployment is down in all 389 metro areas in the U.S. compared to last year.
Karine Jean-Pierre is the principal White House deputy press secretary in the White House briefing room. A different take on Capitol Hill, where the House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy led a news conference with dozens of House Republicans on the steps of the U.S. Capitol.
We have a president in the White House and Democrats in Congress that are completely oblivious to the frustration the American people are feeling at this moment. Their message to the American worker is actually, you will have to deal with higher costs for a while because we want to spend trillions more of your money. We have a Democrat-created inflation we haven't seen in decades. We have gas prices that haven't been this high since the last time Biden was in office. We have borders that are open, are numbers that we've never seen before. People coming across with COVID and being shipped by your taxpayers' money throughout this nation. And a government telling vaccinated Americans to wear a mask. We have children, millions of them, who've been out of school for more than a year. Businesses that were shut down, directed by the government. And for months they were told to get the vaccine and they could go back to work, back to normal, back to school. On schools, recent studies showed, on average, students in grades 1 through 6 were about 4 months behind in reading and 5 months behind in math. On the economy, the U.S. economy grew 6.5% versus the 8.4% that we were expected. They've had enough, and we hear you. We have had enough as well. Amen. We make this pledge to you. We will not allow the CDC to be political. We'll base decisions on science, and we will fight for the American people. The goal is simple. Back to work, back to school, back to health, and back to normal.
The House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy on the steps of the U.S. Capitol, the applause from the other House Republicans standing behind him. The chair of the Pandemic Response Accountability Committee, Michael Horowitz, testified today before a House committee. Rodney Davis, a Republican, asking him about one of the most lucrative scamming opportunities during the pandemic, unemployment insurance fraud from COVID relief funds.
Does your committee have data on how many individuals were victims of identity theft during the pandemic as it relates to attempts to defraud the unemployment insurance system? And how much money has the federal government been defrauded?
Congressman, we've worked at the PRAC closely with the IG at the Labor Department on these issues, and the Department of Labor OIG has done a lot of work in this space and has made some estimates that the amount of fraud could be upwards of 10% at this point, but it's still unknown, I should emphasize, as we're investigating and looking at these issues. But one of the significant issues, as I mentioned and as you referenced, is been identity theft. And the number of people that we've heard from who've expressed concerns about having their identity stolen, and of course, there's really, there's two problems, two very serious problems that arise from that, as you know. One is the program itself gets defrauded, but then separately you have the victim whose identity has been used who has to deal with the fallout from their credit, other issues, security clearances, perhaps, if you're a federal employee or play in a sensitive position, and a number of challenges that arise as a result of that. And that's why we set up the identity fraud working group that we did to try and tackle that problem.
Well, thank you, Mr. Horowitz. As I mentioned, I was a victim myself in my home state of Illinois. And after going through that ordeal, we tried to make sure that all of our constituents who were affected knew the right steps to take to protect themselves and protect their families and their own identity. But with that being said, sir, do you have any policy recommendations that you could lay out that might make it into any final report or recommendation?
We have, as a community, put out some. Actually, the Labor Department IG and the SBI IG have public reports that they've recently issued on that, and certainly would be happy to send them to you. Much of it focused on what the agencies can do to both detect potential identity theft before it occurs, so stop it in its tracks, and then also, when it does occur, how to help victims of identity theft address those problems. So, for example, ensuring, and some of these are maybe obvious steps, but steps that SBAOIG, for example, has recommended with regard to the Economic Injury Disaster Loan Program, referred to as EIDL. The importance, for example, of just maintaining and tracking identity theft complaints, processing information about identity theft and helping to restore identity theft victims to their condition prior to the fraud, including stopping, loan billing statements, preventing delinquency collections, taking what may seem like common sense steps, but steps that aren't necessarily yet being done. And the IG there and the IG at the Labor Department has also made recommendations that they're following up on. I'm happy to
talk
with you further about that.
Testimony from Michael Horowitz, chair of the Pandemic Response Accountability Committee, and questions from Congressman Rodney Davis at today's House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee hearing. And headlines continue across the country about these scams, sometimes involving hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. For instance, this from Associated Press, a Virginia inmate pleading guilty as part of a scheme to obtain pandemic-related unemployment benefits by using personal identifying information of over 30 other prison inmates, the U.S. Department of Justice said. That's from this week. And the article goes on, although the conspirators initially got $436,000, the Virginia Employment Commission was able to reclaim some of the funds after discovering the fraud. You can find the full hearing at our video library at cspan.org. And Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today. A few more headlines. Over 85% of flight attendants have dealt with unruly passengers in the first half of 2021, according to a survey by the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA. And the survey says 71% of the attendants who filed incident reports with airline management didn't receive a follow-up. The union calling on the FAA and Justice Department to protect crew members and passengers. Vice President Kamala Harris presenting a strategy to address root causes of migration from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador to the U.S. The 20-page plan supports short-term relief to deal with pressures like extreme weather while committing sustained attention to long-term motivations for people to leave their countries, like corruption, violence, and poverty. Harris writing, "It will not be easy and progress will not be instantaneous, but we are committed to getting it right." And as President Biden advocates for measures to deal with climate change, three major automakers reportedly will be joining him in pledging to make 40% of car sales electric by 2030. Washington Post says that Ford, General Motors, and Stellantis, previously Fiat Chrysler, will offer support to a shift to electric vehicles, making up 40-50% of their new car sales. The U.S. Senate today passing a $2.1 billion emergency spending bill that deals with U.S. Capitol security, including reimbursing the National Guard for its response during and following the January 6th attack, and also getting Afghans who helped U.S. troops as interpreters and drivers out of that country before the Taliban can exact retribution. But passage came only after an attempt by some Republicans to offset the cost with other cuts, and that attempt failed. We start with Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat and chair of the Appropriations Committee.
This $2.1 billion package is designed to address the aftermath of the violent insurrection that took place on January 6th. designed to heal the remaining scars of the COVID pandemic on the Capitol complex and provide the resources we need to ensure the safety of our Afghan partners as we include our mission in that country. Let me tell you why there is urgency in this, Mr. President. If we don't act, then the Capitol Police will deplete salaries funding in literally a matter of weeks. The National Guard all over the country will be forced to cancel needed training to carry on their mission at home and abroad. And we all remember going out speaking to members of the National Guard from most of our states who are here to help with the security of the Capitol in January. So if we did nothing, that'd be a sort of a security crisis entirely of our own making in what it would do to the Capitol Police and what it would do to our National Guard. But by acting, we prevent that crisis. We provide the Capitol Police with $70.7 million in resources for overtime pay, retention bonuses, mental health services, and new equipment and training. Let me tell you why this is necessary. Since January 6, 73 officers have left the Capitol Police. That's not sustainable. We have to make a strong statement of support for those officers who defended this building and all it stands for on that terrible day.
Senator Patrick Leahy chairs the Appropriations Committee, Democrat from Vermont. Part of his remarks on the Senate floor defending this bill that he negotiated with the ranking Republican on the committee. Before a vote, though, a final vote, Republican Senator Mike Braun raised an objection that the money spent would add to the federal budget deficit, and he proposed spending cuts in other areas.
So we do need to support our Capitol Police, and we will. We need to repay our National Guard, and we will. And we need to protect our allies who kept our troops safe, and we will. Emergencies arise, and the biggest threat to dealing with them, in my opinion, is fiscal irresponsibility in D.C. We could have easily paid for the major parts of this legislation with offsets within the DOD. I think our spending process is broken at every level. We don't do budgets anymore. We vote that the rules don't matter. It seems like Congress can only agree on one thing: deficits and debt don't matter anymore. But they do, and both parties are to blame. And they threaten our ability in the long run to respond to emergencies when they arise, like the important ones in this bill. Not to mention that everything we do here currently is on borrowed money and literally from our kids and our grandkids. My point of order reference has my friend Mike Enzi's name at the top of it. Now, I'm speaking here today for the reasons I just mentioned and in honor of him as well. Mr. President, Senate Amendment 2123 would make new budget.
Can you hold off on raising it so that he makes his amendment pending? Thank you.
Ask consent that your amendment be called up.
I yield the floor.
I ask consent that my amendment be
called up.
Mine and Senator Shelby's
clerk will
be called up.
Senator from Vermont, Mr. Leahy, for himself and Mr. Shelby, proposes an amendment, number 2123.
Mr. President.
Senator from Alabama.
I call up amendment number 2124 and ask that it be reported by number.
Clerk will report.
Senator from Alabama, Mr. Shelby, for Mr. Cotton, proposes an amendment number 2124 to amendment number 2123.
Mr. President.
Senator from Indiana.
Senate Amendment 2123 would make new budget authority available for fiscal year 2021. The Senate Committee on Appropriations has not filed its sub-allocations as required by the Congressional Budget Act. Therefore, I raise a point of order against the amendment pursuant to Section 302C of the Congressional Budget Act of 1974.
Mr. President.
Senator from Vermont.
Mr. President, pursuant to Section 904 of the Congressional Budget Act of 1974, I move to waive all applicable sections of that act, any other applicable budget points of orders for purposes of the pending amendment. I ask for the yeas and nays.
Part of the Senate floor debate, you heard Democrat Patrick Leahy, chair of the Appropriations Committee, also the ranking Republican Richard Shelby, and offering that amendment Republican Mike Braun. The Senate voted to waive the budget rules and not require the spending cuts elsewhere, as Mike Braun wanted. The vote was 72-26. Then the Senate went on to pass the original 2.1 emergency supplemental spending bill unanimously, 98-0. The House had passed a different version of this spending bill, but after the Senate vote, the House called up what the Senate just passed, and then passed it overwhelmingly, 416-11. So now this bill is heading to President Biden's desk for his signature into law, which is expected. Also on spending, this from the Hill newspaper, the House on Thursday passed a sprawling appropriations package to fund the Departments of Health and Human Services, Labor, Veterans Affairs, and other agencies, and set a marker in negotiations to avoid a government shutdown when current funding expires this fall. The package, which includes 7 of the 12 annual appropriations bills to fund the government for the new fiscal year beginning October 1st, passed the lower chamber 219-208 along party lines. Back to the Senate. It got started today on the bipartisan infrastructure spending bill. That's $1.2 trillion for roads, bridges, public transit, broadband, internet. Of new spending within it, $579 billion. Last night, 17 Republicans joined all Democrats in voting to begin the debate on the bill. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said this bill, the bipartisan one, and a second one, Democrats only, are on schedule.
Well, as we all know, last night, the Senate voted by a substantial margin to move forward with a debate on a bipartisan infrastructure bill. I want to commend the group of senators who worked with President Biden to reach a deal. The agreement will ultimately dedicate over $1 trillion to strengthening virtually every major category of our country's physical infrastructure. The vote last night also means that the Senate is on track to reach the two-track goal I laid out for this chamber at the beginning of the month. The first track is the bipartisan bill focused on traditional brick-and-mortar infrastructure projects. The second track is a budget reconciliation bill where Democrats will make historic investments in American jobs, American families, and efforts to fight climate change. In order to start work on a reconciliation bill, the Senate must pass a budget resolution first, and we are on track for that as well. It's been my goal to pass both a bipartisan infrastructure bill and a budget resolution during this work period. Some pundits have called that a tall order. I understand that. But because of the vote last night, the Senate is now moving forward with the bipartisan infrastructure bill, and we are on track to pass both elements of the two-track strategy before we adjourn for August recess. It took some prodding and a few deadlines, but it all has worked out for the better.
The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat, is followed by the Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican, who talked about the two infrastructure spending bills, one he supports, the other he opposes.
Yesterday, I joined a number of my Republican and Democratic colleagues and voted to begin floor consideration of bipartisan compromise legislation for our nation's infrastructure. Our country would benefit a whole lot from some targeted investment in the kinds of real, tangible projects that fit a common sense definition of actual infrastructure. Roads, bridges, ports, and waterways, airports, broadband. A bipartisan compromise to responsibly finance these kinds of investments is guaranteed to be big and complex. is guaranteed to be the kind of legislation that no member on either side of the aisle will think is perfect. But it's an important basic duty of government. I'm glad to see these discussions making progress. I was happy to vote to begin moving the Senate toward what ought to be a robust bipartisan floor process for legislation of this magnitude. This, the kind of focused compromise that our colleagues have been hashing out could not contrast more sharply with the multi-trillion dollar reckless taxing and spending spree that Democrats hope to ram through on a party line vote later this year. Spree is reckless on multiple levels. We're all familiar with the staggering $3.5 trillion bottom line. We all know it would only amp up the painful inflation that's already hammering middle-class families, in large part because of the last partisan deluge of spending Democrats rammed through just a few months ago. But just as alarming is the parade of left-wing ideas that comprise this mess. Turning temporary pandemic welfare payments with no work requirements into a permanent dole, shoving through big chunks of the Green New Deal. Government price fixing that would leave us with fewer new medicines and new cures. And then there's an effort to further inflame the Biden administration's border crisis with a far-left amnesty.
The Senate Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, on the Senate floor. Former President Donald Trump issuing a statement today about the vote Wednesday to bring up the bipartisan infrastructure spending bill, the vote itself bipartisan. Former President Trump's statement reading, under the weak leadership of Mitch McConnell, Senate Republicans continue to lose. He lost Arizona, he lost Georgia, he ignored election fraud, and he doesn't fight. Now he's giving Democrats everything they want and getting nothing in return. No deal is better than a bad deal. Fight for America, not the special interests and radical Democrats. Rhinos are ruining America right alongside communist Democrats. That statement from former President Donald Trump. Former Senate parliamentarian Robert Dove has died. He joined the parliamentarian's office in 1966 and served in the top position in that office in two stints, 1981 through 87 and 1995 through 2001. Both times when Republicans were in the majority. He's one of only six people to serve as Senate parliamentarian since the position was formally created in the 1930s. C-SPAN interviewed Robert Dove in 1986, same year that C-SPAN 2 Television started broadcasting the Senate live. Here's part of the interview where he talks about the pace of the Senate and how it might be influenced by TV coverage.
I remember very well when I first saw the Senate and was probably expecting debates of the caliber of Webster and Calhoun and Clay, and saw delay. Delay is very frustrating to watch, but delay is the way that compromises are made, and the Senate, representing as it does very diverse states, to me is only being successful when it is forging compromises among the interests of those states, and that is the purpose of the delay, and that will be, I think, hard to be patient with, but to me it's a worthwhile process.
Do you think television and radio is going to change this delay process?
I hope not. But I think it will put great pressure on it. I think there will be a lot of pressure from people who watch the Senate to get on with it, to move faster, to be more efficient. And efficiency, to me, is one of those value-loaded words which I think begs the question of the two kinds of errors that the Senate can make. It can either pass bad legislation, which is an error, or it can defeat good legislation, which is an error. The closer it gets to being able to do one of those very well, the farther it gets from being able to do the other one at all. The Senate is designed to be able to thwart bad legislation, which means that it is difficult in the Senate to get through good legislation.
Former Senate parliamentarian Robert Dove, interviewed by C-SPAN's Brian Lamb in 1986 from C-SPAN's video library at cspan.org. Robert Dove has passed away. He was 82 years old. Thanks for being with us today on Washington Today, which you can get as a podcast. Listen and follow wherever you find your podcasts. And if you haven't, download the free C-SPAN radio app. Hope you have a very good evening.